From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump's legal team formally outlined their legal strategy today ahead of the impeachment trial beginning in the Senate tomorrow. But we heard much of their plan on the Sunday talk shows. At the heart of it, abuse of power is not an impeachable offense because it's not a crime. So let's start with a primer on the different views of what the Founding Fathers intended impeachment to be with Chad Pergram, congressional correspondent for Fox News. Chad, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
And Chad, you know attorney Alan Dershowitz will present the constitutional arguments for the president. Here he is on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday explaining his reasoning.
But the articles of impeachment are two non-criminal actions, namely obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. And those are have to be voted on by the Senate.
Let me press that, though. Is it your position that President Trump should not be impeached even if all the evidence and arguments laid out by the House are accepted as fact?
That's right.
Okay, now, Chad, put aside, if you can, that during the Clinton impeachment, Dershowitz argued the impeachment doesn't have to involve a crime. Now he's saying it does. No crime, no impeachment trial. And he's basing it on the country's first presidential impeachment case back in 1868. Can you just remind us?
Yes, Andrew Johnson in 1868. That was a trial that started, in the late winter and ran until springtime with Andrew Johnson. And the founders, especially if you read Federalist 65, that was written by Alexander Hamilton, talking about what they intended with impeachment, they kind of considered the whole concept of impeachment outside the realm of the traditional criminal justice system. In other words, that this was an issue of fitness of office and whether or not you're using the public trust for other purposes. And there may be a crime potentially committed here. You know, that there were certainly questions about that with Richard Nixon. There were certainly issues with that with Bill Clinton. But they weren't specific that this was more of an issue about the public trust and how you use your office. It's a separate kind of league of justice.
But Dershowitz is saying that in the 1868 impeachment trial, the case was made that a crime had to have been committed. And as you said, that sent everyone to the federal papers, and Alexander Hamilton writing, high crimes and misdemeanors includes misconduct that betrays the public trust. So that would seem to discount what Dershowitz is saying. Democrats certainly believe the president betrayed the public trust. But also, didn't the Government Accountability Agency just conclude that Trump did break the law, violated federal law by withholding military aid to Ukraine? So
that's right. And the GAO, you know, the Democrats are going to seize on that GAO statement from just the other day. You know, I did an interview with Alan Barron, who is an attorney who worked with the House on some lower profile impeachments back in the late 80s and other issues, you know, some years ago. And he talks about what seems to catch people, trip them up, is this term high crimes and misdemeanors, that we think of that again in that conventional criminal justice lane. And it's something outside of that. That's what they were really getting at when they were crafting the Federalist Papers and then the Constitution.
So on the face of it, it would seem that Dershowitz is wrong in his interpretation, but this is what we're going
to— And it's all up to interpretation, too.
Right.
That's the other thing.
So we're going to hear this play out. But meanwhile, the Trump team strategy was submitted today. Look, it's 110 pages long. But does anything jump out at you so far in their reasoning?
Yeah, the first thing that they say here is that they describe the House's case as, quote, flimsy and dangerous. They also say in their brief that the House was determined to overturn the 2016 election and interfere in the 2020 election. And the White House is also arguing that the impeachment articles are, quote, structurally deficient. Now, this is their brief, and you can bet that the impeachment managers will start to parse that. They've rearranged the Senate chamber slightly so it's no longer a legislative assembly, and it's kind of like a courtroom. And so they were kind of getting a walkthrough there, but they're going to start to go through that document sent over by the Trump legal defense team, and then they will submit a rebuttal just before they get to the meat and potatoes of the trial tomorrow.
It sounds like, Chad, no one on the Republican side of this case, we didn't hear any lawmakers yesterday, certainly Dershowitz, never said the president did not ask Ukraine to interfere. He didn't keep people from testifying. It sounds as if none of the defense will be he didn't do it. It's just that the defense will be we don't think it rises to a crime, so it's not impeachable. But as you just explained, that's not what an impeachment's supposed to be about.
And that's some of what we've heard from the president's defenders going back to October or so when they started to really get deeply into this inquiry. We're going to hear from the president's defense on Friday and Saturday. What they intend to do here is have the House Democrats, the impeachment managers, present their case in long sessions on Wednesday and Thursday.
12 hours, we understand.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're not starting until 1 o'clock, and some people might say, well, why do you start at 1 o'clock? Well, the Chief Justice presides, and he has other duties across the street at the Supreme Court, so you can't start till 1 o'clock. So this is where these sessions might go late into the night. And then a senior administration official has indicated to me that they don't think that the administration will take all of their time.
Yeah.
That official told me, they said, if they're taking all their time, quote, we're in big trouble, close quote.
Chad Pergram, congressional correspondent for Fox News, will be talking to you again. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, to China now, where there is growing concern about the spread of a new coronavirus that has infected more than 200 people and killed at least three. Joining us now from Beijing is the BBC's Stephen McDonnell. Stephen, tell us more about what health officials know about this virus at this point.
The most crucial thing, actually, is what they don't know, which is the extent to which it can be passed from person to person. Now, so they're thinking that originally it may have jumped from animals to humans at a seafood market, which also has other animals. And everybody who's been sick has come from Wuhan. And the thinking initially was that they'd all had exposure to this same seafood market. But the World Health Organization now says that there probably is, at least to some extent, human-to-human transfer of the virus, but probably this is through some sort of close contact. Now, the reason this makes a big difference is that at the moment, you've got millions of Chinese people crisscrossing the country and traveling overseas for the Lunar New Year celebrations. So, you know, if you can be passing on this virus to other people, then it could spread to many more countries, many more cities. Obviously, it's a much bigger concern for the authorities.
At the risk of making all of our listeners think that they might have this virus, tell me what the symptoms are.
Well, it's giving people pneumonia, fever, this type of thing. But I should also stress that imagine Wuhan is a city of like 11 million people. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of people who are sick, and already dozens have been discharged from hospital. So as long as it's not much worse than we think, it seems to be kind of under control. The flip side of that is that some scientists think that there could actually be thousands of people already infected. It's just that the authorities haven't found them yet. And the reason they say that is just through the mapping that scientists do that would allow them to judge how could it be that this virus has already made its way to Thailand, two people, Japan, mm-hmm. South Korea, as well as Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen. They think it's got to be thousands rather than hundreds.
Now, President Xi is talking about taking every possible measure against this virus. What precautions are being taken right now?
Well, if you go to a train station or to an airport, especially if there is a connection involving the city of Wuhan, there are these extra screening procedures. So flights from Wuhan are arriving and medical officials are boarding the planes and going around and checking everybody's temperature. And if you have a fever, of course, you'll be put to one side. But so you have to pass that screening procedure in order to enter the terminal. So even though it doesn't seem to be madly infecting other people, they're not going to take any chances. And that's because they're worried, of course. They're worried about the example of the SARS virus that people will remember, where there was a cover-up leading to hundreds of people dying and 8,000 people being infected. So this time round, at least, the authorities seem to have learnt their lesson from that and are providing updates as they get them.
Stephen, while we have you, I want to ask you about one other thing that's going on in China today. China is going to ban plastic bags in major cities by the end of this year and in all cities and towns by 2022. That seems like a very big step.
Yeah, I mean, because of the nature of things here, when the government decides to do something, they, you know, put their foot on the gas, as you would say in the States, and get on with it. And initially, at least in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, they've been told this year plastic bags have to go. Not only that, but single-use straws in restaurants, they won't be used. eventually they're saying they're going to phase out all of those sort of plastic tubs you use for home delivery food. Mm-hmm. Now, China, with its breakneck economic growth, is now a huge consumer of the likes of takeaway food. So you can imagine how much plastic that produces. It's all going into the waterways, into landfill. It has been a complete and utter economic disaster for the country. And so I suppose drastic times call for drastic measures. And they've just said, sorry, this is the deadline. You're just going to have to stop using them. There are some exemptions. For example, in outdoor markets that have fresh food, they're going to still be allowed to use plastic bags. I think possibly they haven't worked out a way to get around that. But all these other huge areas of the Chinese society, plastic utensils, for example, gone. And if they enforce it the way they say they're going to, it will transform the environment here.
That is the BBC's Stephen McDonnell joining us from Beijing. Stephen, thanks.
Good to talk to you.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
Kansas is likely to become the 37th state to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The state's Republican state Senate majority leader and its Democratic governor struck a deal earlier this month, overcoming years of opposition from Republicans. Governor Laura Kelly of Kansas joins us from Topeka. Welcome.
It's good to be with you, Jeremy.
So, Governor, Kansas legislators have been trying to pass a Medicaid expansion for years. How did you manage to reach this compromise?
Well, I was a Kansas legislator for 14 years, and I had developed a lot of pretty close, good working relationships on both sides of the aisle. And I was just able to use those relationships when I got into the governor's office to work with key folks to come up with a compromise. We had three different plans for Medicaid expansion sort of out there. And we just came together and picked the best of all of them and got a deal.
Do you think it's a done deal at this point?
Nothing is ever a done deal until the ink is dry. But I'm very optimistic that we will get this Medicaid expansion bill through the process and that it'll come out clean and simple to implement.
How many people are going to be covered as a result of what you're doing?
Well, the estimates are up to 150,000 more Kansans will have access to health care if we pass this.
Now, one of the things that you are going to do is called a premium reduction program to help people who might be eligible stay on their private plans. How much is that going to cost the state, and how big of a compromise is that for you and other Democrats?
Well, it's right now what the bill actually calls for is an actuarial study to determine if that reinsurance, which is what you're talking about, would work in the state of Kansas. It has worked in some other states like Colorado, but we need to have the data before we can decide if it's the route that we want to go in Kansas. We'll know that in about a year. The Medicaid expansion portion of the bill will go first. We'll get that waiver through CMS and then implement January 1st, 2021. We'll get the actuarial study done during that time, and if it's appropriate, we'll implement that by January 2022.
If this happens, Kansas would become the 37th state to expand Medicaid. What would your advice be to people in some of the states that haven't yet? And there are some red states that are considering it now, Oklahoma, Wyoming. Is what you're doing a good model for other states?
You know, I think it is a good model for other states. And we had the advantage, the only advantage I can tell you in not having expanded Medicaid before, we had the advantage of being able to review what all the other states that have expanded have done, what worked and what did not work. So, and we brought them into Kansas to really let us ask questions, get into detail about it. And so I think the plan that we eventually put together sort of is best practices from all of the other states. I would suggest that if states who are getting ready or thinking about expanding, you know, they ought to take a look at the Kansas model, because it is simple, it is clean, it's about as inexpensive an approach you can take, and it's probably as administratively easy to do.
What do you say to people, and I've seen even quotes from some in Kansas, who are calling what you're doing socialized medicine, government-run socialized healthcare? How do you respond to that?
I don't. You know, those are the kinds of things that people who oppose you ideologically will throw out there just to appeal to their base. Kansans, by and large, I think the last poll showed 77% of Kansans wanted Medicaid expanded, and they're going to get it.
I want to ask you about a couple of other issues going on, especially one that has been big in your state, has been all over the news for many years, which is tax cuts. One of your recent predecessors, Governor Sam Brownback, signed into law one of the largest income tax cuts and promised that it would jumpstart the economy. It did not. State revenues crashed. There were spending cuts in education and transportation. But now some Republicans in the legislature in Kansas want to do more income tax cuts. Would you be willing to entertain that?
Well, remember, Jeremy, that in 2017, we reversed most of the Brownback tax experiment.
Right, over the governor's veto.
Exactly, over the governor's veto. It was a bipartisan effort. We got it done. That has put Kansas back on the road to recovery. And last year, I did veto two tax cuts that were sent to my desk because it would have spun us right back into crisis. And we can't survive that. So I continue to ask legislators to be patient. We will be presenting some tax cut approaches this coming session, related mostly to property tax relief and some food sales tax relief for Kansas families who need it the most. We are still not in a position to implement any other tax cuts at this time. Plus, we don't know what we need to do. I put together a tax council, bipartisan again, of really a lot of former legislators who knew a lot about our tax structure from when it actually worked. They presented some recommendations for the short term, which I've already mentioned, and then they'll continue to meet during 2020 to do a deep dive on our overall tax structure and come up with what I expect will be a multi-phase, multi-year approach to rebalancing the Kansas tax code.
What's the situation of the budget like right now? You say you're on the road to recovery.
We are on the road to recovery. We've been able to get ourselves out of court by providing an adequate amount of school funding last year. We will include that again in this year's budget. We were able to decrease transportation transfers, and we will continue to decrease those transfers from the highway fund so that we can implement our fourth comprehensive transportation plan. We have been rebuilding our child welfare system, which was absolutely decimated, resulting in thousands more kids being in our foster care system. We are focused on really working our overcrowding and understaffed correction system. We were able to get the legislature to put some money towards that last year. We'll go back with some recommendations for ways to even continue to remedy the problems we've got over there. So we're on our way. The revenue is there to do that. But I'm asking them to be cautious because we still have a lot of debt to pay down. Mm-hmm. And we do not have a rainy day fund so that when the next recession comes, right now we don't have a cushion and we need to build one. So there are a whole host of reasons to not do anything radical now, but to let the tax council do its work and come up with a sane approach to stabilizing our tax situation in the long haul.
Is Kansas expecting a recession in 2020?
I don't know so much that we're expecting sort of the recession like we experienced in 2007, but it's no secret that one of our largest employers in the state has just had to cut back employees because of the 737 MAX situation. So we're not sure what exactly the fallout will be from that, but that gives us another reason to pause and proceed cautiously.
Governor, as you know, we're about to head into an impeachment trial of the president in the Senate. As you watch that, do you think the president should be removed from office?
You know, Jeremy, as you can tell from the conversation we're having, I am focused like a laser on issues here in Kansas, and I will let our congressional delegation deal with the impeachment issue.
Okay, well, then let me finally ask you a couple of political questions about Kansas, because our listeners and listeners all over the country have paid attention to one person who was thinking about running for the Senate in Kansas. That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He has declined to run as a Republican. Do you think, as somebody who just won statewide in Kansas, that he would have won if he had run?
Well, that's something we will never know. You know, I think those of us in Kansas are now sure that Mike Pompeo will not be running for U.S. Senate. I think the when Bob Dole came out and endorsed another candidate, I think it made it clear that that decision's final.
Interesting. Bob Dole has that kind of sway still in Kansas?
Well, I don't. We'll see. but I think the fact that he was willing to get out and endorse someone other than Mike Pompeo suggests that, you know, Pompeo is not going to be getting in the race.
So what is your advice to whoever the Democrat ends up being? And I know that you've already endorsed a state senator who's running for that Senate seat in Kansas. What would your advice be to how to win as a Democrat in such a red state?
Well, I don't think Senator Beaulieu needs any advice from me. I think she's doing a heck of a job herself. She has already figured out what it takes to win. You know, she announced record fundraising numbers the other day, and she has been out and about all over the state getting to know Kansans and letting them get to know her. So I think she'll do just fine.
That is Kansas Governor Laura Kelly. Governor, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And the governor was referring there to State Senator Barbara Beaulieu, who switched parties from Republican to Democrat in December of 2018, right after the governor won her office. Beaulieu represents a suburban district that has been getting bluer. The governor also mentioned the state's largest employer laying off workers. That would be Spirit AeroSystems, which makes parts of Boeing airplanes, including parts of the grounded 737 MAX. Spirit AeroSystems announced plans this month to lay off 2,800 employees in its Wichita facility. You're listening to Here and Now. The 2020 census begins tomorrow in remote sections of Alaska. The rest of the country will start submitting census forms in mid-March, but the census ad campaign is already well underway with TV spots like this one that shows a series of children talking about counting.
Guys, figuring out who counts in the 2020 census isn't complicated.
Everyone living in your home on April 1st counts.
My aunt and uncle who live with us count.
My best friend who sleeps over every Friday night doesn't count.
Here now, media analyst John Carroll joins us now with more on this. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
So this ad campaign has three distinct phases. How does it break out?
According to a Census Bureau press release, this first phase is the education and awareness phase. It'll run through mid-March. Then there's what they call the motivation slash participation phase, which is trying to get people to actually answer the questionnaire either by online, by phone, by mail. And then finally, there's the follow-up non-response phase where which will coincide with census takers going out door to door to try to get households to respond who haven't already.
The campaign is estimated to cost between $200 and $250 million, which is comparable to the ad budget back in 2010, the last time they did the census. But there are significant differences in other areas.
Right. For one thing, the allocation of money has shifted. In 2010, 8% of the budget went to digital ads. This time around, it's 30%. Consequently, TV has been cut. It was 44% back in 2010. It's now 40% of the budget.
And one of the reasons they're spending so much on digital is because they want a 55% online response from the public, which means filling out the census forms online. Are there going to be Super Bowl ads this time around?
No Super Bowl ad this time. There was one in 2000. There was one in 2010. They say it's not an effective use of taxpayer dollars. What you will see is more hyper-local advertising like gas stations, bus stops, that kind of thing.
Now, one of the big issues that has come up is that there's been concern in some communities after the Census Bureau tried and failed to put that citizenship question on the census form. There's fear that some people might not want to give information to census takers because they think it could be used against them. Is there anything in the ad campaign that addresses those fears?
Well, according to Ad Age magazine, the ads directed at the Latino community are designed to alleviate concerns about government misuse of data. Here's part of one of those spots in which a new arrival to the U.S. asked a couple of friends if it isn't dangerous to fill out the census.
Para nada. Hace 10 años estaba como tú.
Not at all. I was just like you 10 years ago. I filled it out, and look at me. I'm still here. Your personal information can't be shared with ICE nor with the police. Don't worry.
Okay, so that ad is out there. That's going to run on national TV and online for 2 months this spring, but it's the only spot that will specifically address concerns about immigration and customs enforcement and potential deportation?
Yeah, it's a bit of a surprise because there are over 1,000 print, digital, radio, and TV ads. You would think that they would devote a few more to this topic to alleviate those concerns. The ads are supposed to reach 99% of American households multiple times. But this time around, they're only in 13 different languages. They were in 28 different languages back in 2010. So that might be a cause of concern for some people as well.
All right. Well, this is a story we will continue to follow as the census process gets underway officially in Alaska tomorrow. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and as you know, parts of Australia have been on fire for months. At least 28 people have died. The conflagrations in Australia and California before that may have you thinking, how would I handle that? What if you were elderly or disabled or pregnant? Gemma Carey was, but she miscarried, lost the baby in the middle of the Australia fires, and now may have lost faith in having children in a climate crisis. Gemma is an associate professor at the University of New South Wales, ironically studying public health. She wrote about her experience for The Guardian and joins us from Canberra. Gemma, thank you, and we are so sorry for your loss.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, and I mentioned this irony that you were acutely aware of the effects of the smoke where you were living. I mean, describe what was happening in the last stages of your pregnancy.
Yeah, so I think that because of my research, what I do for a job, I was at the start of the smoke a lot more aware of the health effects than other people and being pregnant as well. So there's a particular particle that we're worried about in bushfire smoke. It's particles that are smaller than 2.5 micrometers because they can make their way into your bloodstream, and they're particularly bad for unborn babies. So I was a little bit more conscious of that when we had the smoke start, and when it started it came and went. But very quickly we ended up in a situation where we were 20, 30 times hazardous smoke levels of those particles in Canberra. We had visibility of a few metres. The sky glowed orange. It was really like being in, I mean, we just called it, we're in the apocalypse.
Yeah, apocalypse orange is what you, and that was 20, you know, all the time. And as you say, it's hard to describe what it's like to live in the middle of this sort of slow motion unfolding disaster, but can you try? I mean, people, their cars were packed ready to go if they had to go. Your eyes always on cell phones, everybody comparing, you know, air quality.
Yeah, and one of the things that I wrote about in my Guardian articles was how quickly our whole way of life was disrupted. We had a period of at least 6 weeks with no break in the smoke. We're smoke-free today, but it is going to come back again. The fires are still burning. We're not allowed outside. everyone is constantly checking the air quality meters and readings to see if there's a moment you can go out and do your daily chores. One of the things that really shocked us was how quickly you acclimatized to incredibly dangerous air conditions. So we would be sitting in, you know, a friend's house thinking, can't smell any smoke in here anymore, it's fine, and we'd plug in an air purifier and find that we were sitting in double hazardous smoke conditions in someone's living room. Mm. The infrastructure here, and probably in most places, just isn't set up for that kind of air quality. So it has made its way into all of the operating theatres in the major hospitals, and we have heard stories of, you know, people being put under anaesthetic in a room full of bushfire smoke, which I can only imagine is really terrifying. And babies being born into smoke. And there have been stories of babies coughing as soon as they're born as well.
Oh, boy. Your daily ritual, get up, check the fire warnings, check the air quality reading, check the air purifier. And you note, too, that there's a certain inequity because in some homes you can have a $1,000 air purifier and in others you don't have one at all.
Yeah, and that's what sort of came, I think, to the fore very quickly. So people like me who had the knowledge and the income were able to go and quickly get an air purifier, but I've spoken to people who couldn't afford to and found that, you know, they and their kids have been sitting around in 600 P25 counts. But there was also, you saw that equity and kind of knowledge about what to do as well. Mm. So, as I said, people like me knew a bit in advance and were taking more precautions, whereas I spoke to people who said, you know, we just didn't hear any information from the government. One man I spoke to said, you know, my wife is past her due date and we can't leave now. And if someone had just explained to us how bad this could get or how bad this kind of pollution is for you, you know, we would have left the city earlier, but we're trapped here now. Mm. Which is the other thing that happened here is that all our roads were cut off and the airport was cut off. So we were, the ACT, Australian Capital Territory, around Canberra was completely surrounded by fire. Mm. And there was no way out from the smoke.
And so you find yourself, looking out the window one day saying, what have I done? Because you are pregnant. And you knew that it wasn't just the smoke. It was the stress level and the hormones that were now flooding your body and how they might impact your pregnancy. And then you went for a checkup.
Yeah. So I'd been staying inside with the smoke, knowing all of the health risks for my baby, thinking, what is it going to be like for this child to grow up in this world? You know, is this going to be every summer in Australia now and parts of America too? Is this the new normal? We've never seen anything like this before here. So I was already thinking those questions and was anxious about it. And then we went for just a routine ultrasound and there was no heartbeat. And, you know, there was a bit of me... It's a really conflicted feeling because there's a bit of me that's went, yeah, I don't know about bringing this child into the world, partly because what is the world we're bringing them into? As I said, we haven't seen anything like this. But also I was really aware that this is a terrible start to life in terms of those stress hormones and the amount of smoke I was inhaling, even doing my best to avoid it, and knowing that all of those things play out in the research and having developmental effects and preterm birth and low birth weight. So, I mean, we were devastated, absolutely devastated that we lost the baby, but it is this very complex mixture of sadness, guilt and relief as well. And I think there's a lot of people who kind of have that hard-to-pull-apart set of emotions around having children at this particular point in time.
Well, now what was, as you say, an existential challenge, being pregnant in a climate emergency, becomes a logistical challenge. Having a miscarriage and the medical attention you needed after that miscarriage. And you say this is where, again, the inequity comes because it was a sign of your privilege, you write, that you could get out of Canberra to, you know, have the procedure you needed because you were hearing from other people that, you know, they were going in for surgery inhaling smoke as they went under.
Yeah. So in my pregnancy ultrasound where we didn't find a heartbeat, the room just was full of smoke even then, which is, you know, very, very stressful environment. So as soon as we got home from the ultrasound, I went straight into, well, how do I get out of this city? Because I have the privilege of being able to do that You know, I have networks, I have money where I can fly to another city. And when I talk to people that day, they were saying, yes, yesterday I was in hospital. Yes, the operating theatres were full of smoke. If you can get out, do get out. And I was able to. So the airport reopened the next day. I flew to Melbourne and got the medical care that I needed. Mm. But I'm an absolute minority. Most people in Canberra wouldn't have been able to do that. You know, I happen to know doctors in Melbourne who could help me. You know, and it's not just the operating rooms are full of smoke, but the MRI machines stopped working for 6 or 8 weeks because the smoke alarms on them were going off. So it's affected the whole healthcare system. Mm-hmm. There's no escaping it.
Again, I am sorry. You know, a loss, even if you have these other things to weigh, is a terrible loss. And you say you, like everyone who's been through these fires, you've been changed. But one of the questions you have is, you know, having seen what you've seen, will you get pregnant again? What have you decided?
Again, like a lot of people around me here after these fires are asking themselves that question and have raised it with me. I think where I've sort of landed on it is that there is no right or wrong. It's a very personal question about what's your kind of tolerance for risk and your view of, you know, whether you can give your child a good life in the face of what's happening. At the moment, I still fall on the side that I can, but this experience has really shifted me along, I think. I'm much more unsure and on the edge of that decision than I ever have been before, definitely.
Mm. Well, we wish you and your family and all your friends and neighbors there, we wish you all the best in going forward through this, you know, this really terrible, terrible time. And again, we are sorry for your loss. Gemma Carey, a health researcher at the University of New South Wales, who lived through the terrible fires in Canberra, but suffered a miscarriage, she thinks probably related. By the way, she has a memoir coming out this year, No Matter Our Wreckage, about family and trauma. Gemma, again, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Babies born coughing smoke, what you don't think of. Of course, your thoughts welcome. HereAndNow.org.
As the stock market has continued to climb over the last year, one sector has been a bit of a downer. Marijuana companies like MedMen, Tilray, and Cushco Holdings. Why is that? Well, let's ask Jeremy Burke, senior reporter for Business Insider. Welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me, Jeremy.
Well, and give us some of the context. How much are pot stocks down since their peak?
So according to some indexes, pot stocks are down over 50% since their peak at the beginning of last year, 2019. But if you look at some individual stocks, MedMen, for example, they're down close to 80%.
Wow.
And these levels kind of shift around, obviously, but a lot of value has been wiped off last year.
And why is that? Because there was such excitement about these companies, especially when they went public.
So if you followed the dot-com boom, which granted was a little before my time, there's a term called irrational exuberance, where people are genuinely very excited about an attractive story. Back then, it was the advent of the internet. Now it's, you know, marijuana being legalized in the U.S. and Canada. So people poured their money into it, and people were hopeful that these companies would make more money about a year into legalization in Canada and a lot of states than they actually have been. Part of that is, you know, it's hard to legalize cannabis. You know, it sounds easy at first, but if you're a policymaker, it's where do you put that money? Who gets to make that money? There's equity issues, licensing issues that affect the business. And secondly, you know, there was some bad news in the sector, obviously, last year. Unfortunately, you know, thousands of people across the U.S. were sickened by vapes, and that weighed down on the sector. So it's a combination of all this, I guess, misplaced excitement at the beginning and then reality kind of not living up to those expectations.
So you say misplaced excitement, but I just want to think of two examples. One is,
sure,
I can remember in the last year when the first dispensary opened up in Massachusetts, which just recently legalized recreational marijuana. And there were lines down the block. The people in the town were complaining about the traffic. And then just recently, we heard that in Illinois, where pot just became legal at the beginning of the year, they're running out of it.
Yeah. So two things I'd say on that front. I mean, part of my job as a reporter in the industry, and it's, you know, one of the hazards of my job, is to go visit these legal dispensaries, obviously, in places where adult use of cannabis is legal. And the stores are full of people buying products. Obviously, there's a lot of excitement on the ground. But at the corporate level, that just doesn't quite match up. They have put on these really aggressive forecasts for revenues that just didn't seem to exist. So there is absolutely a disconnect between what you see on the ground and what you see in the public markets. The second point, and it's a bit of a finer detail, is that you have to remember that a lot of these stocks are held by young retail investors. So the price fluctuation isn't really as efficient as, say, if Fidelity or big pension funds were holding these stocks. So people get skittish. And as soon as you see, you know, maybe sales lagging behind expectations one quarter, then people start to pull out and the stocks, you know, are thinly traded enough, they move very quickly.
How much is regulatory uncertainty about marijuana, even in states where it has been legalized, an issue when it comes to the value of these companies?
It's a huge part. And I think that a lot of these companies generated strategies based on legalization moving faster, right? You know, last year, people thought New York would legalize. Obviously, that didn't pan out. Other states on the East Coast, like Pennsylvania and Connecticut, you know, they're talking about it again, but things are moving much slower than expected. And on the federal level, you know, THC, which is the chief psychoactive component of cannabis, is obviously still federally illegal. So that hurts businesses. They can't have access to banks, opening lines of credit. So they're dealing with a lot of issues, and there isn't really a path forward for these issues being solved. And obviously, as you can imagine, Congress right now has bigger fish to fry than banking protection for cannabis companies. So it's unclear when this will happen.
And what about the illegal market for marijuana, which still exists, even though in many places it has been legalized?
So California is the best case study for that, right? When California legalized, they put taxes, which people in the industry would say are much too high, on products. And it's not only the tax on the consumer, it's sort of taxed at every part of the supply chain. So it's a lot more expensive to be a legal cannabis company than it is to sell on the illicit market, right? So if one of the stated goals of cannabis legalization was to erase the black market, in California, people, you know, the novelty of legalization sort of wore off and people are just going back to what's cheaper and, you know, what's more effective for their pocketbook.
So do you expect these pot stocks to rebound at any point?
You know, I don't want to be in the business of offering my predictions on the stock market, but I will say that executives at these companies and investors in these companies that I speak with on a daily basis do expect them to rebound. Whether that will happen soon, I'm not sure, and what those catalysts will be, it remains to be seen. But, you know, there is a sense that, yes, it's an industry getting off the ground. It's, you know, picking itself up by its bootstraps. But, you know, there's hopefully some good news to come in the future. But, you know, it remains to be seen.
That is Jeremy Burke, who is a senior reporter for Business Insider. Jeremy, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.